Hi, I'm Desi Arnaz Jr. Welcome to Letting Go with Guy Finley. Guy is the best-selling author of Let Go and Live in the Now, and is the founding director of nonprofit Life of Learning Foundation. And now, here's Guy Finley.
No human being sets out in their day upon a path that they believe will lead to discouragement. No individual makes a name for himself or herself to live in a set of limitations that not only hinder their general ability to be content and happy, but whose presence serves as a prison for their soul. And human beings on this planet not only live in a prison of the soul, but have found ways to decorate it, found ways to find comfort in their own railing against the severity of that sense of limitation that only the soul imprisoned can know. So we're going to look at some very powerful ideas this morning. And you're going to have to work hard. I have two stories, one shorter than the other and one lengthier. Both hold key elements to ending this unseen, which is the pivotal word for the opening remarks, this unseen condition of one's own consciousness. After all, who would agree to live with a blindfold whose very existence causes that person not only to stumble and fall, but then in the darkness of their own mind, in the unenlightened mind, to find not only reasons why they have the pain they do, apart from being blinded, but to make plans for a life in which somehow they'll escape the pain that's produced by the thing that they pay the least attention to, which is the fact that they can't see. Look how simple this is. Everything that's wrong with us is because we can't see. Everything. So I wrote down a sentence here that I'm going to read to you just before I started speaking that'll set the whole tone, and then we'll see where it takes us from there. There are laws, and we're going to examine a couple of them. Because without understanding principles, true principles, without finding something that is, that is solid, that doesn't change regardless of whether or not we want it to exist. Have you ever noticed how things change depending on whether or not you want it to exist? Seriously. How many of you ever wished that your pain didn't exist? Well, you can, in your moment of wishing that the pain didn't exist, you can find ways around it, can't you? You can go get a drink, you can go plan a trip, you can go make your, whatever, all kinds of stuff you can do. But at the end, all of that didn't change anything, does it? Doesn't change a thing. But there are some things that are unchanging in themselves. So that's what we need to understand. We're going to look at one of these. Here's the sentence. Then I'll explain it. Whatever we affirm in life, so we secretly confirm its opposite. The only exception is the living expression of love when it appears in us. When it is the only exception is the living expression of love, which, when it appears in us, is affirmed by our embrace of it, which is why love conquers all. I'll read it again to you. Whatever we affirm in life, so we secretly confirm its opposite. The only exception is the living expression of love, which, when it appears in us, is affirmed by our embrace of it, which is why love conquers all. Take the first part. Whatever we affirm in life, so we secretly confirm its opposite. If you learned one thing in this lifetime, one thing, it would be that which is most valuable for you to begin to recognize that when you sit and you, and let's talk about what it means to affirm. How many of you sit and affirm your future? I affirm a bright day coming tomorrow. I make plans for myself where I'll finally succeed in ending this pain. Those are affirmations of a kind, aren't they? I am healthy. You name whatever it is that a person affirms, and what you will discover is that it comes with its twin. And its twin is that which moves a person to make the affirmation in the first place. And if a person says, I am strong, it is because weakness in them is telling them they must affirm strength. So they confirm the weakness, they do not come upon the strength they affirm. They strengthen the invisibility of the duality of that mind that believes it can talk itself out of a condition inherent in its own state of consciousness. These are things that a person must understand. A person who affirms wealth confirms their fear of poverty. So that a person who sits and says, I will have this and I'll be that and I'll get there, is doing all of that conversation within a mind that is blinded to itself, and itself being that which wishes it could escape the condition that gives rise to the wish for freedom. That wishes it could escape the condition that gives rise to the idea of freedom. And where does the idea of freedom come to a mind like that, if not from its own conditioned sphere of captivity, if not from what it sees as being what has it held back, and then in imagining what will rescue it, does it not make more real for itself that which it is trying to finally free itself from? How many of you can see the fact of that? That is such an important idea. The only exception, I said, is when the living expression of love, which when it appears in us, is embraced by us. Love really doesn't need affirmation. The embrace of it, which is the spontaneous response of the soul, penetrated, graced by that moment of love, the embrace is the affirmation and does not create a self separate from the love that has appeared in it. And there's a vast difference between a person confirming and affirming that they have love in themselves. You want to see someone who has love in themselves come apart? Just simply mention to them that you don't think they have what they say they have. Then they'll affirm something else for you. They'll show you exactly what the nature was inside of them that sat out to affirm in the first place that love. Love, real love, is not only affirmed in the moment of its expression by the soul that embraces it, but the same soul touched by such love naturally radiates what it has been given. And it affirms to the world the love that has been given, but not as the one who is giving it. Which is another reason that people affirm things, is because it confirms that particular sense of themselves in that moment, whatever that may be. So it's a key idea, this idea that whatever we affirm, we can secretly confirm its opposite. Now, here's another law. Are you up to this today?
Yes.
All right. Take another breath. Just as the life of the sun is greater than the individual beams through which it expresses itself. Light expresses itself in the play of the individual beams that comes down. So here is the life of the sun running through the beams that give it expression. And the life of the sun is greater than the beams that come from it. Yes or no? Greater, isn't it? So is there a life that is greater than the life that runs through us? So is there a life that is greater than this life that runs through us? What we call our life is sustained by a greater life, just as the sunbeams are sustained by a greater source than what expresses them. The reason it's so important to understand this is because it should speak to a certain part of yourself that already knows that there is something amiss. That sure, when you're young and full of hormones or whatever it is that when you're young you're full of, you know, you're pretty much sure nothing's going to stop you. But after a couple whams, you know, after life gives you the old uppercut and the left and the right, and you get knocked down a few times, you start to think to yourself, well, you know, how come I'm getting knocked down all the time? Translation, how come I'm in pain like this? I mean, in my heart, because I see evidence of it, even though I may not be able to execute in terms of some eloquent phrase, the fact of this greater life that runs through a lesser one, I can still sense it. I know it's there. But why am I apart from it? When everything in me wants to embrace that love which affirms its own existence. And it's that idea that intuitively, if you want, a person recognizes that their life is not meant to be spent resisting, running from, reorganizing, resolving, replanning, all of that reliving, that one's life is not meant to be spent reliving it in the hopes that one of these times you're going to get it right, but that there is an inherent fullness to life. There's an inherent fullness to life. What else do we do day in and day out except try to figure out a way to give ourselves that feeling of fullness? Yes or no? And of course, it becomes more and more denigrated as the individuals themselves lose spiritual relationship with life, till a point comes where a person thinks that being full means eating until you can't eat anymore. Because then a person's numb. Then a person's sated instead of spiritually satisfied. And there's a big difference between being sated and spiritually satisfied, isn't there? Even you, and one already knows it too. Because there is no compulsion in spiritual satisfaction. But in everything else that a human being does to find that sense of fullness, there's always compulsion behind it. So there's a tell, if you want, a way to recognize whether or not you're being led by something that's for you or against you. And that's the last setup to the last idea that we have to hold in our mind. We have first the idea that we just talked about, that indeed that whatever we affirm, we secretly confirm its opposite. So when I try to fill myself with something, whatever it may be, I try to fill myself with, I'm trying to get away from the feeling of emptiness. Then we have the idea that there's a life that's greater than the life we see, that there's always that the greater life lives behind the life that we are presently living ourselves. And that life, by its very nature, is obviously at least more full, if you want to use words. It's a different order of fullness than the fullness we understand with our present state. And then lastly, and this is the third idea in this trio of special principles, and you have to take a real deep breath here because this is a challenging one. Anything that is truly full, truly whole, is always half empty. Anything that is truly full, truly whole, is always half empty. Emptiness is a part of fullness. You can't have fullness without emptiness. Now, you have to stretch, and I know that you do, most of you, for that idea. But when you take the whole of something, meaning that which there is nothing apart from, that wholeness must include emptiness, else what is it full of? What has been filled? The old idea of a cup that's half empty. In order for a cup to be half full, there has to be a cup itself that is half empty. And it isn't a question of positive and negatives. It's a question of wholeness itself, in which emptiness and fullness are synonymous events, each fulfilling the other in something greater than the opposites that these fullnesses and emptinesses represent. This is a key idea because it points to something that we don't understand as human beings, which is that emptiness, what we call emptiness, is a natural part of our life. But it's not natural for us because we don't understand what fullness is. We think fullness is the absence of pain. Fullness is the completion of pleasure that has no end. And these are the things that men and women pursue in this life. A way in which it's possible to somehow escape once and for all anything that troubles them or makes them feel as though something is missing from their life. Wholeness is missingness being filled all the time into completion. It is one perfect and pure act of God's life, continuously expressed in the whole of itself, which includes these opposites being resolved by something greater than themselves. This is something that you'll have to think about. I know it's a lot, but I want you to understand. How many of you have an inkling of this idea about emptiness and wholeness? Emptiness and fullness. All right. Now, with these three principles in mind, here's a story. The first one. Take a deep breath. There was once a great king. And you'll find out later why he was truly a great king. But first, we'll look at why the world said he was a great king. And you know, when I was thinking about the story, I couldn't help but think of Alexander the Great, who, as an individual, at one point in time, had conquered essentially the whole of the known world. expanded the boundaries of the known world in some ways by what he conquered. And there is an old story, which I'll pass over quickly here, that when the time came for him to pass, he was in a distant country, and he brought together all the wise men and his doctors, and he said, "I'm the greatest man on earth. I'll give you whatever you need. I must make it home to see my mother before I die. And I know I'm dying." And they said to him, "You know, look, you're greatest of all things. We can't do a thing for you." And when he found out they couldn't do a thing for him, the story goes that he asked to be, when he was paraded through the city upon his return, he asked to be paraded with his hands extended out and open so that the world could see that for all he had nothing. This is an old story. Now, so with that idea about Alexander the Great, here is a king who has conquered the world. Great king, conquered all of the world. Has slaves, has people that work for him, a nation all over the world. And one day his son comes in, and he sees his father seated on the throne, and his head is down, and his shoulders are slumped, and when the boy makes a noise, his father picks up his head, and his son can see that his father is deeply troubled. And the boy can't understand it, because only moments before he'd been thinking about how extraordinary it was to be the son of the king who had conquered the whole world. I mean, what could be better than that? I don't even have to do anything, and I'm there. Now, by the way, keep in mind, all characters in all stories are you. And the young man looks at his father and he says, "Father, what on earth is the trouble? What's going on, man?" Maybe they didn't talk like that. And his father looked at him and realized that it was time that he gave his son something that he had never quite given to himself. This represents a point in your own development, in the development of your soul, of your own inner life, where you actually become cognizant, conscious, barely, but conscious of the fact that it's time that you express to yourself something that you have suspected is true, but now you must go ahead and give the truth to yourself. And he says to his son, he said, I've conquered the whole of the world. And for all that I've conquered, he said, I see now that I have nothing. He said, so there's only one thing left for me to do. And his son says, what's that? He says, now I must conquer the man who would be king. His son didn't understand, perhaps the same way you don't understand what that means. And he said, what do you mean, conquer the man who would be king? And he said, the father looked at him, he said, son, I have overcome the world, but I've never understood what it was that came over me that set me out to do it. I am a prisoner, he said to his son. I am a prisoner of that king, of that king's pain. I'm a slave of that king's dissatisfaction. And all that I have done to conquer the world has been to try to answer that which I have never known in myself. So the last thing that I will do now in my life is I will conquer that man. I will conquer the man who would be king. Now, how many of you have an inkling of what that means interiorly? Hands. The woman who would be queen. The man who would be king. The one who, in short, who is always affirming in life, acting toward what he or she says will resolve their condition, and conquering what they must, knocking people down, throwing people away, disregarding what one's actions does to the world around them. All so that in that act to try and somehow affirm the one who would be king, but unseen confirming confirming the one who lives as an interior prisoner of a host of thoughts and feelings that have been all of their life the secret guide to what they call goodness. Now I must conquer the man who would be king. Now I understand. Why? Clearly, Now, some of you say to yourself, well, that's, you know, I can understand. The king, he's got everything, and, you know, what do you do when you've got everything? Every one of us has everything, in quotes. Oh, yeah, I better say this to you, just because I know how much you won't like it. You have everything you are ever going to have right now. Period. The only thing you will have, in quotes, that'll be different than what you have right now is a different way of looking at what you have right now. What you have won't change, except for the form of it, but not what you extract from it, not the sense of self that is created as a result of it. That will not change, because the nature that produces the plans, the promises, the tomorrows, that nature remains the same nature. And when a person lives from that nature, they live from the man who would be king. And the young prince, if you will, he kind of understood that idea, because even in his own age, well, let me ask a question. How many of you understand what it means to be a slave to your own dissatisfaction? I mean, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? And what does the come away, because you have to see this two things at once. The slave of my dissatisfaction is the same as the king of my plans, isn't it? Isn't it? Yes. The slave of that dissatisfaction is the same as the self seeking a way out of it. And the more I try to find a way out of it, am I not confirming the one inwardly, that nature inwardly, that is the very source of all that compulsion to find a way to escape myself? Yes or no? See, this is hard to do, in case you don't know it. It's hard to get your mind to look at what your mind doesn't want to look at. Because, you know, while you're in the atmosphere, it's suspended as you are, listening to these ideas, the mind can follow it. But the minute that that passes, the mind says, well, wait a minute. I just agreed that whatever it is that's planning my future is planning my prisonership. Now, I don't go along with that. And then I got to go back and bring you back to it again so you can look and see. Whatever it is inside of a human being that sits and plans for a way for him or her to be full and content and whole is confirming that nature that says it has none of these qualities and must find them in time. And the good, true, loving characteristics are not creatures in time. They're not the construction of thought. And no thought can bring a man to these things, can bring a woman to these things, but individuals living in that world unseen to themselves, in which through every act that they make to somehow come to a life that isn't... to come to a life that there's nothing wrong in. To come to a life where I don't have to feel that emptiness. Now, one last idea before I get on to the main story. That emptiness is essential to life. Emptiness is essential to life. No emptiness, no life. No death, no life. It is essential to life. That essential quality, born of the opposites, part of the opposites, that can only be reconciled, by the way, in something that whose... See, this is the problem. I don't think you can understand a wholeness that has emptiness in it, because the mind can't wrap itself around that. The present moment is a wholeness that has emptiness in it. If it weren't empty, then it wouldn't be filled. And if it weren't being filled, then it wouldn't be emptying. That is the truth of the present moment. That is the presence in that now. Our problem as human beings is that momentary sensation, that the passage of that into ourselves, and it's always there. Here's something else. Emptiness is a pressure. Emptiness is a pressure. Not the pressure of feeling empty, but emptiness itself has pressure in it. Now, how can something that doesn't exist have pressure in it? And yet, all day long, there is this quality in our lives that the moment that it is addressed by the mind, It's resisted, it's refused, and then the mind will find a way to resolve that sense of what is proper and necessary for the development, for one's full life, and find ways through their mind to become the king of the next thing that will fill that emptiness for them. How many of you understand that idea?
You're listening to Letting Go with Guy Finley. For more information about Guy's life-empowering ideas, visit GuyFinley.com. We'll be back in a moment.
Hear Guy Finley in person. Guy lives and teaches in Merlin, Oregon, where he speaks four times each week at beautiful nonprofit Life of Learning Foundation. Visit us anytime and hear Guy's life-transforming principles in a friendly, serene, and inspiring environment. Visit GuyFinley.org or call 541-476-1200 to learn more about friendly ongoing classes. You are not alone in your quest for a new life. At Life of Learning, you'll meet others who are also seeking higher understanding, and you'll experience the power and inspiration of hearing Guy Finley in person. Plan to visit us and take the next step in your spiritual development. For information, call 541-476-1200, 541-476-1200, or visit GuyFinley.org. That's GuyFinley.org.
Welcome back to Letting Go with best-selling author Guy Finley.
So, story. Ready? Once upon a time, a man found himself working away in a series of caverns. He wasn't really even sure how he got there. One day he was down in the caverns and working. And everyone was down there. Everybody he knew was down there. Mom, dad, everything. It's like he's found himself in a cavern. Now, the parallel here is that one day a person's living their life and all of a sudden they realize, what am I doing? How do I get here? And why am I doing what I'm doing where I'm doing it? Because the minute that a person becomes conscious of themselves in the smallest way, they recognize that whatever they're doing in order to what? Fill themselves. Make themselves happy. Find a way to make life work. Yada, yada, yada. So here I am, and I'm down in a cave. Now I'm in a cavern, but should the thought occur to me, to him, that I don't want to be there, all of a sudden there's some guards that appear. And they say, you have to work down here. And then the person kind of goes to sleep a little bit, and next week or a month or a year later, they realize, well, what am I doing here? But this fellow, because there's certain supernatural aspects to the story, he can see, well, you know, it makes sense. I mean, you have to do something, and it's not that bad down here. And he's thinking that to himself, all this in one moment, when all of a sudden there's a whistle that blows, and suddenly the guards line up all the people that have been down in their cavern, and they're all told to walk in a single file line back up through these caverns towards what appears to be the surface. And he's thinking to himself, well, this, so maybe it isn't just the cavern life, maybe there's more to it. But as they approach the surface, he begins to, now please listen, because you'll have to work a little bit, he begins to suddenly realize that he's losing his eyesight. Things are going black. Literally, things are going black. And by the time they make it to the surface, he can't see at all. And so he has to hold onto the shoulder of the fellow in front of him, and they walk along until they get back to their barracks. And in their barracks, everything's still pitch black. And this goes on for a period of time, a long time, where when he's down in the caverns working, he can see with no problems. But as he starts to make it back to where they stay when they're not working, he can't see a thing. Now, the parallel here, in case it isn't clear enough, is that when you're doing what you're doing, the reasons why you're doing what you're doing are evident to you. You can be hating somebody and you can see pretty clearly why you need to. You can be resisting and resenting your life, bitter about everything that ever happened to you down in the cavern, and you know why. It's nailed. I got it clear. You can be thinking about why life didn't. You can be thinking about all the plans, the ways in which you're going to listen, the ways in which you're going to escape the cavern. Because I don't want to work in the cavern. I got better things for myself to do. And when you're down in the cavern and thinking about these things, you can see every possible way in which it's possible for you to escape. How many of you understand that? When you're unhappy, it will always come to you in the darkness. Unhappiness is darkness. In that darkness will always come to you a light. But the light is born of the darkness. That's what it means, that whatever you affirm, you confirm its opposite. When that part of you starts to affirm what you must do and become in order to escape this life and this cavern that you can't stand anymore. And by the way, how many of you have changed caverns 500 times? You know exactly what that means. You don't exchange caverns, you're exchanging a set of ideas and ideas only that always give rise to their own opposite. So here he's, and he's saying to himself, how come, because this is what you have to do, how come I can see so good when I'm angry? How come I can see so good when I know what I need to do to change my life? How come I can see so good when I'm thinking it through? But then when I get actually to the life that I've envisioned, then I don't want it. And I'm in the cavern again. But in the cavern, I can see what I have to do not to be there again. And on and on and on that goes. It's as though, in a way, I was trying to give away. It's imagine a man, and he doesn't know he's in a prison. And what is the prison, by the way, other than this thought nature that is forever projecting a point in time where it won't have the torment it does in the cavern? And it can see in the cavern everything it needs to in time in order to be free. But when it gets to the time it imagines, it's still where it has to imagine another time for itself. So what's really happening, and I don't know how to put it, it's like a man, he's in a prison house, and he builds the next wing of his own prison house by the thoughts of how to escape it. So he's actually, there's no physical expression for this, but he's actually pushing the walls out with his mind, not realizing it doesn't matter what the walls are that he pushes out with his mind. Because whatever the mind creates is still a product of the mind. Whatever thought produces is still a product of thought. And if thought could escape itself, it would have built itself out of itself millennia ago. And it can't. So he's seeing this, which is what you have to do. You have to start to see this. How many of you get depressed? You might hold your hands up there for a few minutes while I go through the list. When you're depressed, are you in the upper world, in the bright sunshine, walking free, no problems, nothing to choose, nothing to hate, no one to resent, no condition to push away? So when you're in that negative state, whatever that negative state is, everything that's part of that negative state has that which is needed to escape that negative state, doesn't it? But everything that the negative state projects to escape itself is itself a product of the very negative life from which that state came. Yes or no? Clearly. So here's a man, he's down in the cavern. He's starting to think to himself, you know, every time I get near the surface, now parallel, what does that mean? Every time I think to myself, this life, this cavern life, isn't the life for me. Yo-ho-ho. Yo-ho, cat pirate. It's not for me, this cavern life. I don't want to live in a cavern the rest of my life. Where all I do is work and dream. Work and dream. Meaning, imagine a time in which I won't have to have a life I don't want. Where I don't, I sit and I imagine a day that'll come where I won't regret who I am and who I've been and what I've done. Because isn't that what happens in the caverns? And you see that the nature that sits and wishes it wasn't what it is, or that it wishes it could come up with something, a better version of itself, isn't that nature in the darkness of itself, not knowing that whatever it imagines is coming from that which is it's trying to escape, and it is what it is trying to escape. So our hero, he's down there. Take a deep breath, because we have a ways to go. You know, if you won't fight for yourself, how do you think you're ever going to find freedom? Or are you going to be, and perhaps you are, or are you going to be those people down in that cavern who just decided the only life there is the one they can see when they're negative, which includes their plans for positive times to come? Or, and that same person who every time that the actually just dawns on them for a split second, you know what, I'm still angry. I'm still the subject of every whim that passes through me. And every time they think to themselves, I can't live where I've been living, I must make a change, that suddenly they can't see anymore. Have you ever noticed that? That when you decide, I'm done with the cavern life, I'm not going to do what I'm doing, I'm going to make real changes. That every time I'm real change, all of a sudden, wait a minute. Yes or no?
Yes.
like the three blind mice. I can see when I'm making plans for my escape, but when the moment comes of actually doing what I must, I'm as blind as a bat. And all I can see in those moments where I approach the surface, if you will, are those thoughts and feelings telling me one of three things. Why walk in this direction? There's nothing up here. At least you can see down in the cavern. At least you have something to resent or regret, or at least a hope that one day you won't be down there doing that. Or it says, how do you know it's going to be any better? Because look, you try to walk in that direction, and the nearer you get to where the surface is, the blinder you become. So what are you going to do if you get there? When all you see is nothing. How many of you understand that? When you really want to make some change and you start to try to bring yourself back into the present to live in the moment of truth, that in that very moment it's as though everything goes dark. Mind just suddenly either it has nothing to offer you, or all it can do is tell you, why are you doing this? You can't do anything here. This is emptiness, it tells you. There's nothing here for you. And he's going through this, as you must one day, by the way. This is a true story. Absolute true story. I don't care what religion, what background spiritually a person has. This is what must happen. Period. And he's sitting down there in the caverns and then walking back up. And he thinks to himself, you know, it's a strange phenomena. What's happening, by the way, to him? A bit of self-separation. A little separation is starting to occur inside of him. Meaning something is beginning to live in him that is not part of his mind explaining itself to itself. The beginning of awakening. And he's thinking to himself, well, this is a strange bit. Man, when I'm down here, when I'm at work, now you fill in the blanks, when I'm doing what I do, and I'm this and I'm that, and then comes this, and I'm pretty darn good. And then, but the minute that I realize, like the king who says, now I must conquer the man who would be king, the minute I realize that all that I've overcome, I haven't overcome a thing, I'm still the one being taken over. I still lose my life to whatever comes. And then, this is what has to happen. What good is it? What good is it? And he thinks to himself, I must somehow or other escape this. Now, formerly, for him and for us, escape meant dreaming up a time and place where we wouldn't be subjected to what we're subjected to. But now he knows that escape can have nothing to do with anything that comes to him from his own mind. Because his mind is continually building a new wall, a new wing of the prison, in which he momentarily escapes, redecorates it, and feels as though he's actually accomplished something. But he hasn't accomplished something, and he comes to find that out, and he knows now what must happen. And this brings about a certain condition. And here's the condition it brings about. He begins, instead of, how many of you know this? That there you are, you're going through your day-to-day stuff, you know, caught up, no awareness, basically, just caught in life, reacting to people, you know, yada yada. And then as you get ready to come home or whatever you're doing, then your mind is not, you're not doing that anymore, but you're reliving what you did. You're going over what didn't work and what could work the next time. And you can't see that as the more one does that kind of thinking, this blindfold occurs. Well, here's the point. Our hero, down there in the caverns, begins to ask questions of some of the other inmates. What on earth is happening down here? If you notice that we can see everything we're doing down here, we know all the right things to do amongst ourselves, but we always hurt each other. We're always fighting, trying to get the last piece of bread. But the sooner nearer we get to the surface, the more we can't see where we're going until we get to the surface and there's no way out. What is this blindfold? And the man tells him, well, it's kind of hard to understand. He said, but the story goes that a long, long time ago, a very evil magician took over this world. And this evil magician, it's his power that produces this blindfold. That's how he assures that no one escapes. Because the nearer you get to where it's possible to live outside of these caverns, the more the blindfold appears. So there's a relationship, this fellow went on to say, between the depth and the density of the blindfold and the nearer one is to the surface where one could escape the caverns. And the fellow says to him, well, what about you? He said, well, I have a way to get out. Really? Yes, I do. Remember, you're all characters. Can I go with you? No problem. So the next day, they make their escape. Now, by the way, as they get to the surface, they're blindfolded, meaning that blindfold of darkness, the blackness comes over their eyes. And this fellow follows this fellow. Our hero follows for quite a while, and I have to get to the end of this part. Until they fall in a swamp, and then the next day they run over hot rocks, whatever it is. Over and over again, not only do they not escape, but they get hurt. And one day, our hero says to the fellow who he's following, he says, well, let me ask you a question. He said, how long have you been here? He says, well, I think I'm seventh generation. And our hero says, what do you mean? He says, well, I've been here. I was born here. I was born in this. And so were my parents and the parents before them. As far as I know, that this is it. He says, well, how do you know how to get out of here? He said, well, I'm just trying. And he says to him, here's the point. He realizes that the one who would lead you out of the prison blindfolded is no different than you being blindfolded. What's that passage comes to mind? The blind shall lead the blind and both fall in pit. So our hero, he begins to do something else with his attention. Now take a deep breath. He begins to do something different with his attention. He realizes that part of the problem is that when he's leaving the caverns and headed up towards the surface, that his attention is usurped. He ceases to think about the surface because he's going over all the conditions he wish he didn't have to live under. His mind is drawn back into the cavern where he relives all of the reasons why he wants to escape. So he loses, consciousness of where he is because of where he doesn't want to be. He loses consciousness of where he is because of what he doesn't want to be. And he begins to make the connection that there's a relationship between what he's doing with his attention on the road up and the fact that when he gets to the surface, he can't see anything at all. He's blind again. Now, little by little by little, as he starts to work at that, he actually tries to remember himself what he wants as he's going up. And then the day comes where the following happens. He gets near the surface, and for a split second, something blinds his eyes. For a split second, he sees something that he has never in his life seen before. Now, he doesn't know what it is that in his life he never saw before. He just knows he never saw it, and he knows that it's different than anything he's ever seen before. And he can't get it out of his mind. And so for us who were listening to the story, what he saw was for a split second when he came above the surface of the ground, he saw for a split second the sun as it was setting. For a split second he saw the sun. He'd never seen the light before. All they had were lights, were torches. And he couldn't get it out of his mind, so that then now he had a certain initiative, a certain imperative. When you first realize where you are, when you first see for yourself that what you're doing can't lead you out of where you are, that's the first break of that light. And it's pretty blinding, because what do when we see that we can't escape ourselves with our own plans? We pull back, don't we? We pull away. No different with this man. And little by little, each time, when he'd start the upward journey, he began to make it more and more his attention, his intention, to see what he had seen before. So that came the day when, and this is a key part of the story, came the day when he came up to the surface, he could actually see through the forest that sat over the caverns. He could actually see right through the forest, that just like there was a highway, he could actually see that sun for a minute. He could actually see it for a minute, and he actually felt the sun for a moment. Key idea. He felt the light. He didn't just see it. This is the transition between the first bit of knowledge that one gains intuitively and the gradual awakening in the person of the actual sensing of that light. No longer just a thought, but an actual beginning of a feeling inside of themselves about the nature of truth and what's possible with its help. But the problem was this. The problem was that as soon as he reached the surface, that which he had seen, the light itself, because of the magician, caused that blindfold to come darker and darker and darker. But one morning, a plan came to him. This is what the whole talk's been about. He thought to himself, you know what? When I get to the surface, I know that people have run before, but they always run into the dragons and the demons that live in the dark woods. Or they're captured because they wander into the darkness where the guards are. But I've got an idea. And listen to his idea, because this is how a person, if you will, makes it out. He realized that when he got up to the surface, that he didn't need to see the light. Because if he was attentive enough to it, he could feel the light. And he could follow the feeling. He could follow the sensing that he had of the sun as long as the sun was where it was. So even though he was blinded by this blindfold, meaning he couldn't see the light directly, there was a part of him that could sense the light and move toward, as long as he was quiet enough and attentive enough to be aware of it. Now the parallel here, you mustn't underestimate. Our connection with God's life is so very thin relative to our ability to perceive it. That life that runs through our life is all but gone to us, because we are only present to the life we give ourselves that is a product of this thought nature. But it doesn't mean that life isn't there. It doesn't mean that God isn't there. It doesn't mean that love doesn't live inside of a human being. It means that a human being isn't present to that love. And that gradually a person begins to realize, I've been tricked. The great deceiver. That's what in fact, every religion, that's the great trick, the trickster. I've been deceived. I've been lied to. I have taken my own counsel, my own explanations, my own ability to resolve, to realize, to plan. I've taken that as being life, but all I've remained is an individual trapped inside of these caverns in which I can see what I'm doing when I'm down there, but I can't see in the moments where I need to see. I can't see when I'm getting ready to hurt myself. I can't see when I'm getting ready to be cruel and irritable. I can't see where I'm getting ready to compromise myself. I can't see where it is that I'm being the man who wants to be king regardless of the cost. But there are moments when a person realizes that I must overcome the man who would be king, the one who would rule the world according to his own discoveries of himself. Instead of that, that all has to be laid down. And a person starts to understand that. And that's the same as that approaching the surface. And here's what he did finally one day when he realized that there was nothing else that he could do. When he realized there was nothing else he could do. Listen to this idea. We don't find God or realize his grace through our own possibilities, but in the discovery of the impossibility of ever realizing his light through what we can imagine. Because the present set of possibilities are nothing but a perpetuation of our mind, isn't it? That's what we call that's the cavern, and that's the blindness too. You got to the surface. Take a deep breath. You're on the surface now. Couldn't see a thing. But he felt. He knew the right direction. This is so pure and so innocent and clean and simple, really. And it's so, in the human mind, this present nature of ours, it hates this idea. It hates it. You know why? Because he could only take about a step and a half in that direction before his attention was stolen by his own mind telling him there was no reason for doing this, that all that was going to happen was something bad if he stayed in this darkness. Because you see, in the darkness, meaning the blindfold, all he had was the remembrance of that moment where he touched something and something touched him. Down in the cavern, I can see, man. Down in the cavern, I have a life. I know who I am and what I need to do down there. But up here, meaning on the surface where the sun is, where the light is, where God's life is, I can't see, and all I have are those moments where I can barely touch it. But he had reached the point where he knew it was impossible for him to remain the person he'd been. And so when he lost contact with the sun, and try to understand what it means, you can do this today. You go out and you feel the difference when you face the sun and you turn away from it. You close your eyes and feel the difference. Because it's a parallel between the sun, S-O-N, and its light and life inside of you and what you must turn and face. And he collapsed over to the right side, just right where he was, just sat down. And can you imagine what going through his mind? He can't see anything. Everything telling him something's going to come and get him. What a waste it is. What's he going to eat? Who's going to take care of him? At least down there he's got someone to take care of him. He's got guards, if nothing else. But he stayed the night. He didn't even know it was night. The whole thing was night to him. But in the morning, he's sitting there, and off to his side, this is just how it is, off to his side, he felt the warmth of the sun coming up, and he turned to face it, and he took about 5 steps in the direction of it till his mind again distracted him, and he lost track, he wandered off, and it sat down. He did this for 40 days and 40 nights. But something was happening that he couldn't see was happening. And I tell you, this is the truth. I tell you, this is the truth. This is what no one in the prison knows. And this is what was happening to him. The magician's black blinder was slowly being dissolved by the light that he was facing. So that each time he got up and took those few brave steps that he could and kept going in the direction of the light, each time he did that, without him knowing it, the light itself was having an action on the blinder. so that it was becoming more and more transparent. Only for a long time, for some many days, it wasn't transparent at all. But little by little, he began to correlate the sensation of the direction that he needed to do the right, to do the true, to do the good, regardless of its cost. He began to actually start to see for himself where it was. So it wasn't a blind walk anymore. I tell you that the spiritual walk must be a blind walk in the beginning, or you are blinded by the magician. And this is why people don't want the true spiritual life, because we want the life that's known. We want the life that has promise in it, as given to us by the parts of us that can only promise the past in a reconfigured future, which is all it can do. And he walked, and that blinder finally disappeared. Just disappeared. And he was a free man. Now, what was he free in? And what freedom? Last part of the talk. Take a breath. Freedom is not in time. Freedom is not in time. Freedom is now. Meaning, it has no conditions. It has no constraints. It doesn't come from something, and it isn't headed toward anything. We don't live in that time, capital T. We live in the time of ourselves. We live in the cavern of a consciousness whose entire existence is not only founded in time, in thought, but then escapes itself in time through more thought. The story of the man finally waking up and realizing that he had to face the light and try as best he could to let what he sensed of it lead him in that direction is the story of the individual who gradually recognizes that what man taking thought can find freedom, can add one cubit to his stature. Is that slow but necessary and painful to the nature that knows itself in the cavern, to that point where he starts to realize the only thing I must do, I must remember that if I'm not present to myself, if I'm not sensing the light, meaning if I'm not in the moment where this is taking place, where my life is, then I am back in the cavern creating for myself a life that I try to fill, but by the very attempt to fill it, I'm actually serving the false emptiness. I'm doing the part to keep myself a prisoner. Last sentence, last idea. What we're after can't be created. It already is. The freedom that one wishes that he could find a way to realize will never be found by the one who wishes to find that. Because the self that seeks to escape, no matter what it is that it named as necessary to escape, is the extension of the prison that it would get away from. When the mind sees that, when you can see that, you can begin to realize from just another whole of even my experience of life, it proves all this. So now what do? I'm at the surface, and you can be on the surface anytime you want. Do you understand that? It's instantaneous transportation from the dungeon, from the cavern to the surface. Instantaneous. Do it right now. You bring yourself up to the surface. Where is the light? What does that mean? Be present. Because when you're truly present, goes away the prison. But it doesn't just go away like you want it to go away. Because in the moment of where one is present to oneself, they can actually feel, and this is such an important idea, they can actually feel the cavern calling to them. Now I'll say it in one more different way, and we'll close the talk. Your past is not a power in the kingdom of heaven. It is only a power here in the kingdom of time. And the power that it has here in the kingdom of time is that of a double-edged sword. With one side, it cleaves away to freedom, and with the other side, it creates the cage that you must cleave the next time. Real freedom is not outside of you. God's life runs through you. And God's life has nothing to do with the life that one does serving time. And every time you feel bad about yourself, you're serving time. Every time you worry about something, you're serving time. Every time you plan to conquer another kingdom, you're serving time. Every time you regret your own past, you're serving time. Every time you hate someone, you're serving time. If you want to cease serving time, you must enter into the timeless kingdom, God's life, and that is in this present moment. It is its expression now, in which the emptiness that you're presently trying to escape is not a problem. It's part of the promise of yourself. And when you understand that fully, you'll no longer seek to escape. And when you no longer seek to escape, you will be free of that blinder that tells you you can see by it. And you'll be brought into the present moment where your real life has always been. Now you must do the work for yourself to find that out.
Hello, I'm Desi Arnaz Jr. You've been listening to Letting Go with best-selling author Guy Finley. To learn more about Guy Finley and his nonprofit Life of Learning Foundation, visit GuyFinley.com, where you'll find a host of free, life-changing information. Thanks for joining us today.